Hey guys, you're listening to the Reside Podcast. I'm Brooke, your host. Cultivating community is something I am so passionate about, which is why I created this platform to collectively celebrate togetherness. Today's guest is Cindy Wu, the program manager at Houston Welcomes Refugees, an organization dedicated to easing the resettlement process for refugees settling in Houston. Cindy has such a big heart for the refugee community here in Houston, and she enlightened me on so many aspects of the journey of an individual seeking refuge in a place like America, the different barriers they encounter once getting to the resettlement country, and what we can do to promote smooth integration versus assimilation for the refugee population. When I think about what it means to cultivate community, Cindy embodies all of those things. This is such an important conversation, so I really hope you lean into this one. Now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Cindy. Welcome, everyone. I am here with Cindy Wu.
Hi, Brooke.
I know that you have a huge heart for refugees. Maybe you can just start off by introducing yourself, telling us who you are and a little bit about your journey to what you're doing right now.
So I am a native Houstonian, and I've lived here for most of my life, although I have left and come back. Left the first time for college, left the second time to live in Mexico City for a year, and then left again to do missions in East Asia with my new husband, and then left a fourth time to go to seminary at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in the Boston area. As the daughter of immigrants, obviously I've always been concerned about immigrants and their experience integrating into American life. Just grew up with a lot of questions, even about my own identity as a Taiwanese American. So, you know, God has always put people of different backgrounds in my life. I went to very diverse middle schools, high school, university experience, all very diverse. And I started to really think more about refugees when I was in seminary. So I took a class. There's really two classes that impacted my life. The first was on biblical global justice. And so I was learning about human trafficking and about poverty and trying to really formulate a thoughtful theology, kind of biblical perspective on suffering and on justice and injustice. So that class really exposed me to a lot of things that I wouldn't say I had maybe never heard of before, but had never done any type of deep study on certain topics. Yeah. So that class started getting me thinking about global justice issues and migration. And then another class I took, it was called Christianity in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And one of our assigned readings for that class was a book called Blood Brothers by Elias Shakur. He's a Palestinian Christian peacemaker. And the book tells of his experience as a Palestinian Christian being displaced by the creation of Israel as a nation state. When I was reading the book, what I realized was that my perspective on Palestinians was so one-sided. Growing up as a child of the 80s, there was just really one imagination of Palestinians, and that was that they were turban-clad, you know, PLO terrorists. Right. And as I was reading the book, I realized that even as someone who had been a believer, you know, considered myself fairly worldly in terms of like knowing things globally, I didn't know Palestinians were Christians. I thought they were all Muslim. I never even gave one thought to what happened to Palestinians when Israel was formed as a nation. So that really opened my eyes to the prejudice that I had held against an entire people group, just the bigger picture of what God was doing through migration. And so that was really when I started to become interested in refugees.
And so from there, you took the class. What was your journey from kind of that moment to turning it into really your life work and what you're doing now?
So I remember when we were in seminary, my husband and I were thinking about going overseas again. And this time, rather than going to East Asia, we were actually interested in the Middle East. And God, through some circumstances and kind of redirecting us, closed that door pretty clearly to us. And I remember feeling kind of depressed that we weren't going to the nations. And then I felt like the Lord reminded me, you live in one of the most diverse cities in the United States. Well, I was in Boston at the time, but we knew that we were probably going back to Houston. I just felt like God was saying, I am bringing the nations to Houston. You have the world in your backyard. Well, and so it was a combination of my desire to be around, you know, the nations, internationals, immigrants, plus a desire to seek justice that really converged at refugees because they are persecuted people from the nations. Mm. And so God, I almost had an audible word, refugees, in my ear when I was sitting there in the library one day, just kind of complaining to God, like, oh, you know, we're not going to go overseas and I'm so disappointed. What am I going to do with my life? And so it was once God gave me that clarity, I worked with a professor to do some independent coursework. And then for my master's thesis, I had to create a project. And that project became a workbook to help Christians in America understand the global refugee crisis and view it from a biblical and theological and reflective perspective. That curriculum was written for an audience of one, my advisor. But in 2017, I actually was able to get it published with William Carey Library. Mm-hmm. And now it's on Amazon and I've been able to teach from it and, you know, had different churches and my denomination use it as a resource. But in terms of getting involved personally and in terms of a more activistic side, when we came back to Houston, I actually ended up homeschooling my kids part-time for 10 years. And so I couldn't work vocationally with refugees, but I just volunteered with the YMCA. They're one of the five resettlement agencies here in Houston. Mm-hmm. So I volunteered for many years. And then almost exactly 2 years ago, I found out about this job opening at Houston Welcomes Refugees, applied, got the job, and have now been the program manager for 2 years. And I really love my job.
It's neat to look back and reflect on, you know, creating the workbook, and you intended it for a party of one, and now it's sitting on our bookshelf. So such a cool thing. And I know that you've done a lot of work and it's really opened a lot of people's eyes, specifically in Houston. You mentioned that it's one of the most diverse cities, and yet I feel like really me included, a lot of people don't have really a lot of knowledge on just the process, all that an individual fleeing their country is going through before they end up in Houston. And then, you know, that begins a whole new journey there in and of itself. Could you maybe just spend a little bit of time talking about really the process, maybe the why behind, like, why would a family flee their country, their home country? What are some of those underlying reasons? And then how does kind of placement in the new country work?
Well, it is a long process. It can take decades. But first, a refugee has to be defined by the United Nations as a refugee. And this is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution based on one of five characteristics, based on their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Hmm. There are United Nations personnel who serve in areas of conflict. And someone who is interested in resettlement has to be identified by the United Nations as a refugee. Hmm. And then they have to undergo a very extensive vetting process. There is obviously an application, interviews to corroborate their stories of persecution. They have to undergo, for instance, for the United States, they have to undergo multiple layers of vetting, background mm-hmm. checks, screenings through 8 government agencies like the FBI, Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security. They have to go through medical tests. The government collects a lot of their personal data. They do iris scans, fingerprint scans, you know, biometric data. So it's very extensive. And in order to be approved for that, you really have to show that you are one of the most vulnerable of all of the world's 26 million refugees. The United Nations only considers those that are in the most vulnerable category. This might include survivors of torture, women and children, people with severe medical conditions. But you can't just sign up for resettlement. You can't just ask, say, oh, I would like to be resettled and I want to go to the United States. United Nations is the one who determines what country you're going to go to. So when a refugee is assigned to a country like the United States, there are 9 national agencies, and the refugee will be assigned to one of those agencies. Each of those agencies has a local affiliate in cities around the United States. And so before a refugee even sets foot on an airplane, they have to pass that screening and that vetting process and get their, you know, their medical checkups. Refugees are expected to cover the costs of their resettlement, including the airplane flight. And this is a recurring process that takes, on average, 18 months to 2 years to complete. As I mentioned, it can take decades for refugees to finally be resettled. And that's only because a lot of refugees actually want to go home. Resettlement is a costly and complicated process, a life-saving one. And so it's a good option for those refugees who are unable to go back home and are also unable to remain in their host country.
That's an incredibly tedious process, not to mention some of the most vulnerable among those fleeing their home country are the ones that are considered for resettlement. So the trauma of whatever their situation is, adding on all of the complexities with the process, I can only imagine like just the hardship that they endure before they even step foot in the resettlement country. You work a lot with resettlement process once the refugees are here, specifically in Houston. I can only imagine that there's a lot of adversity that they face when they step foot into the resettlement country. Can you share a little bit from your perspective about what are some of the like biggest barriers or maybe some of the most intimidating barriers for families when they're arriving in a new country, specifically Houston?
One of the barriers that stands out the most is language. If you can't speak English, then it limits everything, your ability to get around, your ability to find a job, your education. So definitely adjusting to a new language is a huge barrier, especially for families who have low literacy, even in their home country. The barriers will differ depending on where a family is coming from. If you have, let's say, a Middle Easterner who is urban and educated, when they come, they sometimes might already know a little bit of English. They might have some type of skill set that allows them to have more job opportunities. If you are a refugee who's been living for 20 years in a camp, when you come, you might have low literacy, you might have more severe health issues, and just perhaps not even accustomed to some of the more urban ways of life.
Yeah.
Some other barriers that refugees will experience are cultural. Many of the refugees that we resettle come from countries that have a much more conservative culture than the United States. There might be women who weren't permitted to drive in their home country, women who weren't expected to work in their home country, and they were maybe very domestic. But then when they come to the States, they might find that they really ought to work in order to help, you know, the family. Also, the dynamics of coming here and just kind of seeing how marriages and parenting and, you know, male-female dynamics are really different is for many people a massive adjustment.
That's a lot.
I think I can add one more is, you know, religion for some of the families from Muslim countries. If a family comes from a Muslim country and they're accustomed to practicing their faith in a public way, that maybe here in the United States, they don't feel as open to do so, less access to religious and culturally sensitive food and public spaces. Yeah. Also, there's sometimes can develop in a lot of families a generational gap where the parents, perhaps because of their culture or their background or their lack of English, over time, sometimes they start to rely on their children to serve as cultural brokers, to serve as interpreters. And so sometimes that can cause some tension in the family because, you know, you want to restore and you want to maintain the parents' honor. But for practical purposes, a lot of times the children have to step into positions where they are mediating things for their parents. And so that can cause some difficulties with adjustment.
The word that comes to mind when you're saying that, and maybe this is not what you're talking about, but is assimilation to the new culture that they're in, but then trying to still like straddle that versus respecting the culture of where they came from.
Yes. I think there's a lot of pressure externally for refugees to assimilate to the culture. I really like the word integration over assimilation, because assimilation can often imply that the refugee is to shed their cultural identity and try right. to fit in to the American culture. Whereas right. integrate is, it goes in both directions, where yeah. people around them are accepting them for who they are, and refugees yeah. are also trying to embrace their new homeland as well.
I like that. And I think there's a lot that we can do as a host country or a resettlement country to educate ourselves and to learn more, such that we are encouraging and promoting integration over assimilation. Can you maybe speak to, like, what are some things that people, you know, here in the U.S. can do to promote integration over assimilation?
That's a really great question, because I think that a lot of us, first of all, don't know who is coming to the city. So I think the very first step is just education, trying to learn, you know, who are the agencies, where are refugees being resettled, and what country are they coming from? For instance, a lot of people would be very surprised to find out that in the past 2 or 3 years, the top nationality of refugees coming to the United States is Afghan. We are actually the top receiving city in the United States currently for people from Afghanistan.
Interesting.
And so when you're walking about and you see someone and they look like they're from Central Asia, you might not realize that these are by and large people who served with the U.S. military. They aided the U.S. government. And as a result, their lives and their families' lives were threatened.
Wow.
And so the United States government has a program called Special Immigrant Visa Program, and it allows Iraqis and Afghans who served with the U.S. military to come over on a refugee visa.
Wow.
So I would say, first, learn who's coming to your city. Secondly, I'm going to use three examples based off of Houston Welcomes Refugees programs, because I think that these three programs that we offer really cover a wide range of local volunteers. So the first is providing welcome kits for refugees. These are donated household items that help a refugee to set up their home. Every refugee, when they come, receives a temporary amount of federal welcome money, as well as case management. Once that runs out, then they're expected to be self-sufficient.
Wow.
And that self-sufficiency can begin as early as 3 months or maybe 6 or 8 months. And if you can imagine all of the barriers that we just talked about that they have to cross in order to reach that point of self-sufficiency, it's really not realistic. So a lot of people think that refugees come and they are a burden on the economy, but they really don't receive as much as I think some people think that they do. So by providing donated household items, you are empowering refugees to have the freedom to spend some of their own savings or that federal welcome money to purchase the things that they really want to buy for their family, instead of needing to spend it on things like trash bags and toilet paper and dish soap. The second program that we offer is move-in teams. Move-in teams are small groups of people who show up at an apartment the day of an arrival. They take items from the welcome kits and they make an empty apartment into a home. So we have different kits for every room of the home, bathroom kits and kitchen kits, and the move-in teams will go and set up those rooms for the refugee. At the end of doing the move-ins, we always pray for the family that's coming. And I love to imagine what it's like to step into an apartment. You are a travel-weary refugee. You're not expecting anything. And you walk in and you see that the towels were hung up and the beds were made and there's food in the pantry and food in the fridge. We also have welcome teams, which are small groups of people who befriend a refugee for a period of 6 months. I really think that the welcome teams is one of the best ways to really see God in action, the way that he's bringing people from around the world to meet people here in Houston. And it's through forming those friendships that you can learn about one another, learn one another's stories, and just have an appreciation of people who have suffered in their home country, but they want to come to the United States. They want to rebuild their lives, and they want to contribute to our economy and to our country. Yeah. A lot of them feel very grateful to be here, but it's bittersweet because most refugees, they don't want to come to the United States. They were forced to come because of their circumstances.
Yeah.
So I think one of the best things that locals can do to help refugees integrate rather than just forcing assimilation upon them is to become their friend and do it in a way in which you are learning from refugees. You're not there to rescue them or to enable them by doing everything for them. You want to teach them skills so that they can become self-sufficient and feel empowered to live life here independently.
I was reading, I think it was one of the materials that Houston Welcomes Refugees provided, maybe to volunteers or something, but the article was talking about the need to recognize that, like, refugees and asylum seekers, we need to view them as more than just people in need, but actually, like, viewing them as valued partners and contributors in society. And I think that's so true. And it changes the way we interact with people when we have, you know, that different viewpoint.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, Brooke, because when we talk about the refugee crisis, there's 26 million people today that are refugees, and it's really easy to get overwhelmed by that number or not be able to wrap your arms around that number. But behind every number is a story. It's a human life, and it's people who were created in the image of God. Yeah. And I think it's really important when refugees come, the best way to help them integrate is to preserve their dignity, to allow them to have likes and dislikes, and to offer their opinions, and to be honest about who they are, and not put refugees in a subservient position where they have to be eternally grateful for everything that they get from the United States, for all of your help, for your friendship. To not require them to be grateful all the time, to allow them to feel some of the pain of having to leave their home against their will. I do think that just the idea of seeing their humanity and their dignity and just never losing sight of that is really important.
That in and of itself is a different viewpoint, at least from what you see on TV even, or hear in the news. You know, I feel like a lot of those avenues tend to dehumanize the person that is, you know, seeking refuge, and not to mention all of the trauma and the craziness that they've experienced even leading up to resettlement. The news definitely tends to strip all of that away and create a lot of us versus them, or I don't know what that is, but
yes, I do think that us versus them is something that has been heightened in the past few years. I think also viewing refugees as a threat, you know, people who want to come and leech off of our economy. Refugees, there's been studies done that after 8 years living in the United States, refugees are starting to, they're basically by that point have paid back everything that they have received from the US government in assistance. And I think that refugees also generally come with a very strong desire to work and contribute. Mm-hmm. Many of the refugees are actually incentivized to work through matching grant federal programs that that require you to be employed or at least actively seeking employment in order to get some forms of assistance. So the United States government has it's set up so that refugees are actually incentivized to work.
At the end of the day, like you said, we're all humans and have human needs and are just trying to, you know, provide for ourselves and our families and do so in a safe manner. And I think that the work you're doing is so unique and needed. And I know that God's getting all the glory through that. So This podcast is all about creating community. Do you have any other final thoughts just in general about what people can do to just help build a better community as it pertains to individuals who are seeking resettlement?
Yes. So Houston has a pretty strong infrastructure to receive refugees. There are many, many nonprofits around the city. There are mentoring programs where you can do one-on-one mentoring with a refugee student. There are women's empowerment groups. I know of three, one for Congolese women, one for Afghan women, and one for Arab women. Mm-hmm. If you have a heart for women, there are refugee farmers here in Houston. You can purchase a farm share through someone like Plant It Forward, and you can support refugee urban farming as well as receive some really healthy, you know, organic, locally grown food.
Wait, that's super cool. I did not know about that.
There are ESL classes. You know, English is a huge need for almost all refugees when they come. And so there are organizations like Prestige Learning Institute or BEI, stands for Bilingual Education Institute, who offer classes for refugees. There are also sports programs for refugees. So there's an organization called Revival Sports, and they do camps for refugee students. Again, there's just such a variety of ways that people can use their gifts and their skill sets and their connections to help refugees. But I think overall, I would just encourage people to make a friend. You know, just like that saying goes, it takes a village to raise a child. It really takes a village also to help refugees integrate. Mm. There's so many different facets of integration, you know, from educational to vocational, even where you go grocery shopping. And so we just live in a very well-resourced city that has so many different nonprofits and individuals who really, truly want to help refugees thrive.
Yeah, that's awesome. And kind of creating that personal relationship, I feel like is, everyone needs that. Whether you've lived in a community for years and years and years, or you're just arriving to a new space, that human connection is absolutely key.
I believe that Christians in particular are uniquely called by God to care for refugees. And in Deuteronomy 10, 18 and 19, scripture says, God defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. The Bible makes it really clear that God's heart is a welcoming heart. People who were far from God, who weren't walking in his ways, who were like strangers to him, he welcomed them into his family. And so I believe that Christians have a special mandate to do so because of our identification with refugees. Mm-hmm. My desire is that Christians will catch a vision for how their spiritual identification with refugees can really inspire them to befriend refugees and help them to see the love of Christ through us, based in our understanding, our theological understanding of our very own identity, our own identity before God. Yeah. So that's really what spurs me on a lot as a Christian, to continue to encourage the Christian community here in Houston to care for refugees.
It's really awesome that you said that, actually, just talking about identity. My pastor yesterday was talking about, we were in the book of Revelation, and we're talking about our identity as believers. When we get to heaven, there's going to be such this picture of diversity, and God is a global God. And so people from all different tribes and nations, like, worshiping together, and how that's literally our identity as believers. Even just like limiting the experience that we get to enjoy that, like, goodness when we just experience like sameness. We live in one of the most diverse cities, but if we're just interacting with people that only look and think like us, then we're like limiting that part of the goodness of God and like really our identity in that. Cindy, thanks so much for being on the Reside podcast today. I just really appreciate you sharing your heart for the refugee community and all the work that you're doing in Houston. It's so great. And thank you for sharing your gifts with us today. It's just an honor to know you.
Thank you, Brooke. This is so fun.
Okay, I don't know about you, but I left my conversation with Cindy feeling both energized and challenged all at the same time about what it means to create a welcoming community for everyone. I will have all the ways you can connect with Cindy over on my Instagram at Reside Podcast, so definitely check that out. Guys, thanks for tuning in today. I hope that this show is challenging you to be a cultivator of community. Whether you've been somewhere for your whole life or you're just planting roots, I want you to know that you're not alone in your efforts to create community. The next episode releases on May 26th. That's two Wednesdays from now. I am having another incredible guest on the show who will be bringing the heat. Guys, we have our first guy on the Reside Podcast, my good friend Blake Ball. Blake is someone that immediately comes to mind when I think about how he has created a unique community in the space that he's in. So you will not want to miss that episode. In the meantime, I would love to hear from you. You can connect with me on my Instagram at Reside Podcast. Let me know how you have used the show to create community in your own space. All right, guys, I hope you have a great rest of your week. The sun is shining right now for me. If it is for you too, I hope that you're enjoying it and getting outside and getting some vitamin D. I'll see you back in 2 weeks on May 26th for my conversation with Blake. Goodbye for now.